advanced. My God, Claire. Did you see that? Did you see him? Yes. There is that, too. It's undeniable. Pat Bender is some kind of force on stage. She's not sure if it's because she knows who his father is, or perhaps because he's playing himself. But for one quick, delusional moment, she wonders if this might be the greatest actor she's ever seen. Then the lights come up again. It's a simple play. From that opening scene, the story follows Pat and Lydia out on their parallel journeys. In his, Pat spends 3 drunken years in the wilderness trying to tame his demons. He performs a musical comedy monologue about the bands he used to be in, and about failing Lydia, a show that eventually gets him dragged to London and Scotland by an exuberant young Irish music producer. For Pat, the trip smacks of desperation, a misguided final attempt at becoming famous. And it all blows up when Pat betrays Joe by sleeping with Umi, the girl his young friend loves. Joe runs off with Pat's money, and he ends up stranded in London. In Lydia's parallel story, her mother dies suddenly, and Lydia finds herself stuck caring for her senile stepfather Lyle, a man she's never gotten along with. Lyle provides daft comic relief, constantly forgetting that his wife has died, asking the 35-year-old Lydia why she isn't at school. Lydia wants to move him into a nursing home, but Lyle fights to stay with her, and Lydia can't quite do it. In a storytelling device that works better than Claire expects, Lydia fills in the gaps and marks the passage of time by talking on the phone to Pat's mother, Deborah, in Idaho. She never appears on stage, but is an unseen, unheard presence on the other end of the phone. "Lyle wet the bed today," Lydia says, pausing for a response from the unseen Deborah, or Dee, as she sometimes calls her. "Yes, Dee, it would be natural, except it was my bed. I looked up and he was standing on my bed, pissing a hot streak and shouting, 'Where are the hand towels?' Finally, Lyle burns himself in the oven while Lydia's at work, and she has no choice but to move him into a nursing home. Lyle cries when she tells him about it. "You'll be fine," she insists. "I promise."
"I'm not worried about me," Lyle says. "It's just, I promised your mother. I don't know who will take care of you now."
In the wake of that realization that Lyle believes he has been caring for her, Lydia understands that she's most alive when she's caring for someone else, and she goes to Idaho to take care of Pat's ailing mother. Then, one night, she's asleep in Deborah's living room when the phone rings. The lights come up on the other side of the stage, revealing Pat, standing in a red phone booth calling his mother for help. At first, Lydia is excited to hear from him, but all Pat seems to care about is that he's run out of money and needs help to get home from London. He doesn't even ask about his mother. Lydia goes quiet on the other end of the call.
"Wait, what time is it there?" he asks.
3, Lydia says quietly, and Pat's head falls to his chest exactly as it did in the first scene.
"Who is it, dear?"
comes a voice from offstage, the first words Pat's mother has spoken in the entire play. In his London phone booth, Pat whispers,
"Do it, Lydia."
Lydia takes a deep breath, says,
"Nobody,"
and hangs up, the light going out in the phone booth. Pat is reduced to being a vagrant in London, ragged, sitting drunk on a street corner playing his guitar cross-legged. He's busking, panhandling to make enough money to get home. A passing Londoner stops and offers Pat a 20-euro note if he'll play a love song. Pat starts to play the song Lydia, but he stops. He can't do it. Back in Idaho, with snow on the cabin window marking the passage of time, Lydia gets another phone call. Her stepfather has died in the nursing home. She thanks the caller and goes back to making tea for Pat's mother, but she can't. She just stares at her hands. She seems entirely alone in the scene, in the world.
and that's when a knock comes at the door. She answers. It is Pat Bender, framed in the same doorway Lydia stood in at the beginning of the play. Lydia stares at her long-lost boyfriend, this derelict Odysseus who's been wandering the world trying to get home. It's the first time they've been on stage together since that awful moment when he stood before her naked at the start of the play. Another long silence between them follows, echoing the first. Extends as long as an audience can possibly bear. Somebody say something! Until Pat Bender gives just the slightest shudder on stage and whispers, "Am I too late?" Somehow conveying even more nakedness than in the first scene. Lydia shakes her head no. His mother is still alive. Pat's shoulders slump in relief and exhaustion and humility, and he holds out his hands, an act of surrender. Dee's voice comes again from off stage. "Who is it, dear?" Lydia glances over her shoulder, and somehow the moment stretches even longer. "Nobody," Pat replies, his voice a broken husk. Then Lydia reaches out for his hand, and in the instant their hands touch, the lights go down. The play is over. Claire gasps, releasing what feels like 90 minutes of air. All the travelers feel it, some kind of completion, and in the rush of applause they feel, too, the explorer's serendipity, the accidental cathartic discovery of oneself. In the midst of this release, Michael leans over to Claire and whispers again, "Did you see that?" On her other side, Pasquale Tursi holds his hand to his heart as if suffering an attack.
"Bravo," he says,
and then,
"È troppo tardi?"
Claire has to guess at his meaning, for their erstwhile Italian translator seems unreachable, his head in his hands.
"Fuck me," Shane says. "I think I've wasted my whole life."
Claire, too, finds herself drawn inward by what she's just seen. Earlier, she told Shane that her relationship with Daryl was hopeless. Now she realizes that throughout the play she was thinking of Daryl, hopeless, irredeemable Daryl, the boyfriend she can't seem to let go of. Maybe all love is hopeless. Maybe Michael Dean's rule is wiser than he knows. We want what we want. We love who we love. Claire pulls her phone out and turns it on. She sees the latest text from Daryl. "Please just let me know you are okay." She types back, "I'm okay." Next to her, Michael Dean puts his hand on her arm.
"I'm buying it," he says.
Claire glances up from her phone, thinking for a moment that Michael is talking about Daryl. Then she understands. She wonders if her deal with fate is still in play. Is Frontman the great movie that will allow her to stay in the business? "You want to buy the play?" she asks.
"I want to buy everything," Michael Dean says. "The play, his songs, all of it."
He stands up and looks around the little theater.
"I'm buying the whole goddamn thing."
By flashing her business card, "Hollywood? No shit." Claire gets an enthusiastic invitation to the after party from a goateed and liberally pierced doorman named Keith. On his directions, they walk a block from the theater toward a brick storefront, which opens to a wide set of stairs, the building intentionally unfinished, all exposed pipes and half-exposed brick. It reminds Claire of climbing to countless parties in college. But there's something off in the scale, in the width of hallways and the heights of ceilings, all the extravagant wasted space in these old western towns. Pasquale pauses at the door.
"E qui lei? Is she here?"
"Maybe," says Shane, looking up from his phone.
"C'è una festa per gli attori."
It is a party for the actors. Shane returns to his phone and sends a text message to Sandra. "Can we talk, please? I realize now what an ass I've been." Pasquale looks up at the building where Dee might be, removes his hat, smooths his hair, and starts up the stairs. At the top of the landing, Claire helps the winded Michael Dean up the last steps. There are three doors to three apartments on the second floor, and they walk to the back of the building, to the only open door, propped open with a jug of wine. This back apartment is big and lovely in the same primitive way as the rest of the building. It takes a moment for them to adjust to the candlelight. It's a huge two-story open loft with high ceilings. The room itself is a work of art, or a junk pile, filled with old school lockers, hockey sticks, and newspaper boxes, all of this surrounding a curved staircase made of old timbers, which seems to float in thin air. Upon further inspection, they can see that the staircase is held with three lines of coiled cable. "This whole apartment is furnished with found art," says Keith, the theater doorman who arrives right behind them. He has spiky, thin hair and painful-looking studs in his lips, neck, upper ears, and nose, as well as pirate hoops in his ears. He has acted in Tagney productions himself, he tells them, but he's also a poet, painter, and video artist. "That's all?" Claire wonders. "Interpretive dancer? Sand sculptor?" "A video artist?" Michael is intrigued. "And is your camera nearby?" "I always have my camera," Keith says, and he produces a small, simple digital from his pocket. "My life is my documentary." Pasquale scans the party, but there's no sign of Dee. He leans over to ask Shane for help, but his translator is staring helplessly at Sandra's return text. "You just now realized you're an ass? Leave me alone." Keith sees Pasquale and Michael looking around, mistakes this for curiosity, and steps in to explain. The apartment's designer, he says, is a former Vietnam vet, featured last month in Dwell magazine. His general concept is that every design form has an innate maturity alongside its youthful nature, that too often we cast aside the more interesting forms just when they're starting to grow into this older, more interesting second nature. Two old hockey sticks, who cares? But hockey sticks made into a chair? Now that's something. "It's all wonderful," Michael says earnestly, gazing around at the room. The cast and crew aren't at the party yet. So far, it's just 15 or 20 black glasses and hippie-sandaled audience members, with their low talk, little squalls of laughter, all of them taking turns inspecting the strange travelers of the Lost Dean party. The crowd is familiar, Claire thinks. Smaller, a little rougher around the edges, but not so much different from an after-party anywhere. Wine and snacks are lined up on a metallic table made from the door of an old freight elevator. A small backhoe bucket is filled with ice and beer. Claire is relieved when she goes to the bathroom to find that the toilet is an actual toilet and not an old boat motor. Finally, the cast and crew begin arriving. Word of the great Michael Dean's presence seems to be spreading throughout the crowd, and the ambitious make their way over, casually mentioning their appearance in the straight-to-video movies shot in Spokane, appearing alongside Cuba Gooding Jr., Antonio Banderas, John Travolta's sister. Everyone Claire meets seems to be an artist of some kind. Actors and musicians and painters and graphic artists and ballet instructors and writers and sculptors and more potters than a town this size could possibly support. Even the teachers and attorneys also act or play in bands or sculpt blocks of ice, Michael fascinated by all of them. Claire is amazed at his energy and genuine curiosity. He's also on his third glass of wine, more than she's ever seen him drink. An attractive older woman in a sundress, her deep, sun-worshipping wrinkles, the opposite of Michael's smooth skin, leans in close and actually touches his forehead. "Jesus," she says. "I love your face." As if it's a piece of art he's created. "Thank you," Michael says, because it is his work of art. The woman introduces herself as Phantom, with an F, and explains that she makes tiny sculptures out of soap, which she sells at craft shows and barter fairs.
I'd love to see them, Michael says. Is everyone here an artist?
I know, Phantom says as she digs through her bag. It gets old, huh? While Michael looks at tiny soap art, the rest of the Dean party is growing anxious. Pasquale watches the door nervously as his lovesick translator, still stinging over Sandra's texted rejection, pours a tall glass from a bottle of Canadian whiskey, and Claire asks Keith about the play.
Some intense shit, huh? Says Keith. Deborah mostly puts on kiddie plays, musicals, holiday farces, whatever gets the skiers off the mountain for a couple of hours. But once a year, she and Lydia do something original like this. She gets crap from the board sometimes, from the cranky Christians especially, but that was the trade-off for her. Come keep the tourists happy, and once a year you can bust out something like that.
By this time, all of the cast and crew have made it to the party, except for Pat and Lydia. Claire finds herself in conversation with Shannon, the actress who played the girl in bed with Pat at the start of the play.
I understand you're from...
Shannon swallows, can barely say the word.
Hollywood?
She blinks quickly, twice.
What's that like?
2 glasses of wine in, Claire feels the strain of the last 48 hours and smiles, stops to think about the question.
Yes, what is it like?
Certainly not like she dreamed. But maybe that's okay. We want what we want. At home, she works herself into a frenzy worrying about what she isn't, and perhaps loses track of just where she is. She takes a moment to look around. At this apartment built of garbage on some crazy island of artists in the mountains, where Michael is happily giving out business cards to soap makers and actors, telling them he might have something for them. Where Pasquale is nervously watching the door for a woman he hasn't seen in nearly 50 years. Where a quickly drunk Shane has rolled up his sleeve to explain the origin of his tattoo to an impressed Keith. And that's when Claire realizes that Pat Bender and his mother and his girlfriend are not coming to this after-party.
What? Oh, yeah,
Keith says, confirming her suspicion.
They never come to the after-party. It'd kill Pat to be around all this booze and weed. Where are they?
Michael asks.
Probably up at the cabin, Keith said. Chilling with Dee.
Michael Dean grabs Keith by the arm.
Will you take us there?
Claire jumps in. Maybe we should wait until morning, Michael.
No,
says the leader of the hope-drunk Dean party. He glances over at old patient Pasquale and makes one last fateful decision.
It's been almost 50 years. No more waiting.
Chapter 19. The Requiem. April 1962. Porto Vergogna, Italy. Pasquale woke in darkness. He sat up and reached for his watch. 4:30. He heard the fishermen's low voices and the sound of boats skidding down to the shore. He rose, dressed quickly, and hurried down through the dusky pre-dawn to the shore, where Tommaso the Communist was fixing his gear in his boat.
What are you doing here?
Tommaso asked. Pasquale asked Tommaso if he would motor him to La Spezia later for his mother's requiem mass. Tommaso touched his chest.
Of course,
he said. He would fish for a few hours and then come back to take Pasquale before lunch. Would that work?
Yes, perfect, Pasquale said. Thank you.
His old friend tipped his cap, climbed back in the boat, and pulled the starter rope, the motor clearing its throat. Pasquale watched Tommaso join the other fishermen, their shells bobbing on the soft rocking sea. Pasquale went back to the hotel and went to bed, but sleep wouldn't come. He lay on his back and thought of Di More in bed just above him. In the summers sometimes, his parents used to take him to the beach at Chiavari. Once he was digging in the sand when he saw a beautiful woman sunning herself on a blanket. Her skin glistened. Pasquale couldn't stop staring. When she finally packed up her blanket and left, she'd waved at him, but young Pasquale was far too mesmerized to wave back. Then he saw something fall from her bag. He ran over and picked it from the sand. It was a ring, set with some kind of reddish stone. Pasquale held it in his hand for a moment as the woman walked away. Then he looked up to see that his mother was watching him, waiting to see what he would do. "Signora!" he called after the woman and chased her down the beach. The woman stopped, took the ring back, thanked him, patted him on the head, and gave him a 50 lira coin. When he returned, Pasquale's mother said, "I hope that is what you would have done even if I wasn't watching you." Pasquale wasn't sure what she meant. "Sometimes," she said, "what we want to do and what we must do are not the same." She put a hand on his shoulder. "Pasquo, the smaller the space between your desire and what is right, the happier you will be." He couldn't tell his mother why he hadn't returned the ring right away. He imagined that if he gave a girl a ring, they would be married, and he would have to leave his parents. And while his mother's lecture had gone over his 7-year-old head, Pasquale saw now what she meant. How much easier life would be if our intentions and our desires could always be aligned. When the sun finally crested the cliffs, Pasquale washed at the basin in his room and put on his old stiff suit. Downstairs he found his Aunt Valeria awake in the kitchen, sitting in her favorite chair. She glanced sideways at his suit.
"I can't go to the funeral mass," his aunt sighed. "I can't face the priest."
Pasquale said he understood, and he went outside to smoke on the patio. With the fishermen away, the town felt empty, only the wharf cats moving around the piazza. There was a light haze. The sun had not yet burned off the morning fog, and the waves were falling lifelessly on the shallow rocks. He heard footsteps on the stairs. How long had he waited for an American guest? And now he had two. The footsteps were heavy on the wooden patio, and soon Alvis Bender joined him. Alvis lit his pipe, bent his neck one way and then the other. He rubbed the light bruise over his eye.
"My fighting days are over, Pasquale."
"Are you hurt?"
Pasquale asked.
"My pride."
Alvis took a pull from his pipe.
"It's funny," he said in smoke. "I used to come here because it was quiet and I thought I could avoid the world long enough to write. No more, I guess, eh, Pasquale?"
Pasquale considered his friend's face. It had such an open quality. Was such a clearly American face, like Dee's face, like Michael Dean's face. He believed he could spot an American anywhere by that quality, that openness, that stubborn belief in possibility, a quality that, in his estimation, even the youngest Italians lacked. Perhaps it was the difference in age between the countries. America, with its expansive youth, building all those drive-in movie theaters and cowboy restaurants. Italians living in endless contraction, in the artifacts of generations, in the bones of empires. This reminded him of Alvis Bender's contention that stories were like nations. Italy, a great epic poem. Britain, a thick novel. America, a brash motion picture in Technicolor. And he remembered, too, Di More saying she'd spent years waiting for her movie to start, and that she'd almost missed out on her life waiting for it. Alvis lit his pipe again.
"Lei è molto bella," he said.
"She is very beautiful." Pasquale turned to Alvis. He'd meant Di More, of course, but at that moment Pasquale had been thinking of Amedea.
"Sì,"
Pasquale said. Then he said in English,
"Alvis, today is the Requiem Mass for my mother."
So gracious were these two men, so fond of each other, that they sometimes had conversations speaking entirely in the other's language.
"Sì, Pasquale,"
Dispiace. Devo venire?
No, thank you. I am go this alone.
Posso fare qualcosa?
Yes, there was one thing he could do, Pasquale said. He looked up to see Tommaso the Communist puttering back into the cove. Almost time. Pasquale turned to Alvis and switched back to Italian to make sure he said it right.
If I do not come back tonight, I need you to do something for me.
Of course, Alvis said.
Can you take care of Di More? Make sure she gets back safely to America.
Why, are you going somewhere, Pasquale?
Pasquale reached in his pocket and handed Alvis the money that Michael Dean had given him.
And give this to her.
Of course, Alvis said. And again, but where are you going?
Thank you, Pasquale said, again choosing not to answer that question, afraid that if he said aloud what he intended, he might lose the strength to do it.
Tommaso's boat was nearly at the pier. Pasquale patted his American friend on the arm, looked around the small village, and without another word went into the hotel. In the kitchen, Valeria was making breakfast. His aunt never made breakfast, even though Carlo had insisted for years that a hotel hoping to cater to French and Americans must offer breakfast.
It's a lazy man's meal, she always said. What laggard expects to eat before doing any work?
But this morning she was making a French brioche and brewing espresso.
Is the American whore coming down to eat?
Valeria asked. Here it was. The moment he figured out who he was to be. Pasquale took a breath and climbed the stairs to see if Di More was hungry. He could tell by the light coming from beneath the door that her window shutters were open. He took a deep breath to steel himself and tapped lightly on the door.
Come in.
She was sitting up in bed, pulling her long hair into a ponytail.
I can't believe how long I slept, she said. You don't realize how tired you are until you sleep for 12 hours.
She smiled at him, and in that moment Pasquale doubted that he could ever bridge the gap between his intentions and his desires.
You look handsome, Pasquale, she said.
And she looked down at her own clothes, the same outfit she'd worn to the train station. Tight black pants, a blouse, and a wool sweater. She laughed.
I guess all of my things are still at the station in La Spezia.
Pasquale looked down at his feet, trying not to meet her eyes.
Is everything okay, Pasquale?
Yes, he said, and he looked up, catching her eyes. When he wasn't in the room with her, he had one sense of what was right. But the minute he saw those eyes...
You come down for breakfast now? Is a brioche and café.
Yes, she said. I'll be right down. He couldn't say the rest. Pasquale nodded slightly and turned to leave.
Thank you, Pasquale, she said.
Hearing his name caused him to turn back again. Looking in her eyes was like standing by a door slightly ajar. How could you not push open the door, see what lay inside? She smiled at him.
Do you remember my first night here, when we agreed that we could say anything to each other? That we wouldn't hold back?
Yes, Pasquale managed to say. She laughed uneasily.
Well, it's strange. I woke up this morning and I realized I had no idea what to do now. If I'm going to have this baby, if I'm going to keep acting, if I'm going to go to Switzerland or back to the States, I honestly don't have any idea. But when I woke up, I felt okay. Do you know why?
Pasquale gripped the doorknob. He shook his head no.
I was glad that I'd get to see you again.
Yes, he said.
Me too.
And that door seemed to open a little. And the glimpse he had beyond the door tortured him. He wanted to say more, to say everything on his mind, but he couldn't. It wasn't a question of language. He doubted the words existed at all, in any language.
Well,
Dee said. I'll be right down. And then, just as he was turning away, she added quietly, the words seeming just to tip from her beautiful lips, spilling like water. Then maybe we can talk about what happens next.
Next.
Yes. Pasquale wasn't sure how he managed to get back out of the room, but he did. He pulled her door closed behind him and stood with his hand outstretched against it, breathing deeply. Finally, he pushed off the door, made it to the stairs, and eventually to his room. Pasquale grabbed his coat, his hat, and his packed bag off his bed. He came out of his room and down the stairs. At the bottom, Valeria was waiting for him.
Pasqua, she said. Will you ask the priest to say a prayer for me?
He said he would. Then he kissed his aunt on the cheek and went outside. Alvis Bender was standing on the patio smoking his pipe. Pasquale patted his American friend on the arm and started down the path to the pier, to where Tommaso the Communist was waiting for him. Tommaso dropped his cigarette and ground it into the rock.
You look good, Pasquale. Your mother would be proud.
Pasquale climbed in the fish-gut-stained boat and sat in the bow, his knees together like a schoolboy at a desk. He was unable to stop his eyes from sweeping the front of the hotel, where Dee More had just stepped onto the porch and was standing next to Alvis Bender. She shielded the sun from her eyes and looked down on him curiously. Again, Pasquale felt the separate pulls of his mind and body. And right then, he honestly didn't know which way it would go. Would he stay in the boat? Or would he run up the path to the hotel and take her in his arms? And what would she do if he did? There was nothing explicit between them, nothing more than that slightly open door. And yet, what could be more alluring? In that moment, Pasquale Tursi finally felt wrenched in two. His life was two lives now, the life he would have and the life he would forever wonder about. Please, Pasquale rasped to Tommaso. Go. The old fisherman tugged on the pull start, but the motor didn't catch. And Dee More called from the hotel patio.
Pasquale! Where are you going?
Please, Pasquale whispered to Tommaso, his legs shaking now. Finally the motor caught. Tommaso sat down in back, took the tiller and started puttering them away from the pier, out of the cove. On the patio, Dee More turned to Alvis Bender for an explanation. Alvis must have told her that Pasquale's mother had died, because her hand went to her mouth. And Pasquale forced himself to look away then. It was like prying a magnet off steel, but he did it. Turned forward in the boat, closed his eyes, still seeing her standing there in his memory. He shook with the strain of not looking back until they rounded the breakwater into the open sea, and Pasquale exhaled, his head falling to his chest.
You are a strange young man, Tommaso the Communist said.
In La Spezia, Pasquale thanked his old friend and watched Tommaso steer his little fishing boat away from the harbor, back toward the channel between Porto Venere and Isola Palmaria. There he went to the little chapel near the cemetery, where the priest was waiting, his thin hair run with comb lines. Two old funeral-attending women and a feral-looking altar boy were on hand for the occasion, the chapel dark, moldy, and empty, candle-lit. The Requiem Mass seemed to have nothing to do with his mother, and Pasquale was momentarily shocked when he heard her name in the priest's Latin drone.
Antonia Requiem Aeterna Dona Eis Domine.
Right, he thought. She's gone. And in that realization, he broke down. After the funeral, the priest agreed to say a prayer for Pasquale's aunt, and to say the Trigesimo in a few weeks, and Pasquale paid the man again. The priest raised his hand to bless him, but Pasquale had already turned to go. Exhausted, Pasquale went to the train station to check on Dee More's luggage. It was waiting for her. Pasquale paid the agent and told him she'd be coming for her bags the next day. Then he arranged for a water taxi to collect Di More and Alvis Bender, and he bought himself a train ticket to Florence. Pasquale settled into his seat and went right to sleep, jerking awake as the train pulled into Florence station. He got a room 3 blocks from the Piazza Massimo d'Azeglio, took a bath, and dressed again in his suit. In the dusky last light of that endless day, Pasquale stood smoking in the shade of the trees across the courtyard until he saw Amedea's family return from their evening walk, strung out like a family of quail. And when beautiful Amedea lifted Bruno from the stroller, Pasquale thought again of his mother on the beach that day, her fear that when she was gone, Pasquale wouldn't be able to bridge the gap between what he wanted and what was right. He wished he could reassure his mother. A man wants many things in life, but when one of them is also the right thing, he would be a fool not to choose it. Pasquale waited until the Montelupos disappeared inside their house. Then he ground his cigarette into the gravel, crossed the piazza, and stepped up to the huge black door. He rang the bell. There were footfalls on the other side, and then Amedea's father answered, his thick, bald head tilted back, fierce eyes taking in Pasquale as if he were surveying an unacceptable meal in a café. Behind her father, Amedea's sister Donata saw Pasquale and covered her mouth with her hand. She turned and squealed up the stairs.
Amedea!
Bruno looked back at his daughter, and then sternly again at Pasquale, who carefully removed his hat.
Yes? Asked Bruno Montelupo. What is it?
Behind her father, on the stairs, lithe, lovely Amedea appeared, shaking her head slightly, as if still trying to dissuade him. But Pasquale also thought he saw, beneath the hand that covered her mouth, a smile.
Sir?
He said.
I am Pasquale Tursi of Porto Vergogna. I am here to ask for the hand of your daughter Amedea.
He cleared his throat.
I am here for my son.
Chapter 20. The Infinite Blaze. Recently, Sandpoint, Idaho. Deborah wakes in the dark, on the back deck of her cabin, on the tree side where she likes to watch the stars. The air is cool, sky clear, pinpricks of light fierce tonight. Insistent. They don't twinkle, they burn. The front deck of the cabin overlooks the mountain-rimmed glacial lake, and this is the view that causes most visitors to gasp. But she doesn't like the front deck as much at night, when light from the docks, the boats, and the other cabins compete for attention. She prefers it back here, in the shade of the house, in a tight, round clearing of pine and fir trees, where it's just her and the sky, where she can see for 50 trillion miles, for 1 billion years. She'd never really been a sky watcher until she married Alvis, who liked to drive into the Cascades and look for clear spots away from the light pollution. He considered it a shame when people couldn't grasp the infinite, a failure not just of imagination, but of simple vision. She hears the crunch of gravel. That must have been what woke her. Pat's Jeep coming down the long driveway. They're home from the play. How long was she asleep? She reaches out for her cold teacup. A while. She feels toasty warm except for one of her feet, which has slipped out of the blanket. Pat has rigged up 2 fireplace-shaped space heaters on either side of her favorite chaise so that she can sleep out here. She balked at first at the waste of electricity. She could just wait until summer. But Pat promised to turn off every light every time he left a room, for the rest of my life, if she would only indulge him this one thing. And she has to admit, it is lovely sleeping out here. It's her favorite thing, waking outside in the cold, nestled in the little incubator her son built for her. She turns off the heaters, checks the horrible pad she slept on now. It's dry, thank God. pulls her big cardigan around herself and starts for the house, a little wobbly still. Inside, she hears the garage door close below. The cabin sits on a jutting point, 200 feet above a bay on this deep mountain lake. The house is mostly vertical, designed by her and built with the money she got from selling their home in Seattle. 4 stories, with an open floor plan and a 2-car garage below. Pat and Lydia have the 2nd floor to themselves. The 3rd is common living space, an open living room, kitchen, dining area. And the top floor belongs to Dee. Bedroom, bathroom with jacuzzi tub, and her sitting room. When she was having it built, of course, she had no idea she would spend virtually her entire time here as a cancer patient. And then, after the treatments had all been exhausted and she decided to let the disease run its course, in this weakened end time. If she had, she might have gone with a rancher, with fewer stairs. "Mom, we're home!" He yells up the stairs every time he comes in the house, and she pretends she doesn't know why. "Still alive," she's tempted to say, but it would sound harsh. She doesn't feel bitter that way, but it's funny to her, the way people treat the dying, like aliens. She starts down the staircase.
"How'd it go tonight? Good crowd?"
"Small but happy," Lydia calls up the stairs. "The ending worked better tonight."
"Are you hungry?"
Deborah asks. Pat is always hungry after a performance, and he's been especially famished while doing this play. As soon as Lydia finished writing it, she showed it to Deborah, who was torn. It was the best thing Lydia had ever written, a perfect capstone to the cycle of autobiographical pieces Lydia started years earlier with a play about her parents' divorce. And Deborah fully believed that she couldn't finish the cycle without writing about Pat. The real problem with Frontman was that there was only one person she could imagine playing Pat, and that was Pat. She and Lydia both worried that he might backslide if he had to relive those days. But Deborah told Lydia she should let him read it. He took the pages downstairs and came back up 3 hours later, kissed Lydia, and insisted they do it, and that he play himself. It would be harder, he thought, to watch someone else play him at the peak of his self-absorption than it would to play it all out again himself. He's been acting with the Tagney Group for more than a year now. It gives him a healthy outlet for performing, not in the narcissistic way he used to with his bands, but in a tighter, disciplined, collaborative spirit. And he's a natural, of course. Deborah is beating eggs when Pat swings around the kitchen pillar and kisses her cheek. Kid still fills the room. "Ted and Isola said to say hi."
"Yeah?"
She pours the eggs in the pan.
"And how are they?"
"Crazy right-wing nut jobs." She slices cheese for his omelet, Pat eating every other piece.
"I hope you told them that," she says, "because I'm getting awfully tired of them constantly writing checks to support the theater."
"They want us to do Thoroughly Modern Millie. Ted wants to be in it. Said I'd be great in it, too. Can you imagine? Me and Ted in a play together?"
"Yeah, I'm not sure you have the chops to act with Ted."
"That's because I had such a bad teacher," he says. Then, "How are you feeling?"
"I'm good," she says.
"Did you take a Dilaudid?"
"No."
She hates pain medication. Doesn't want to miss a thing.
"I feel fine."
Pat puts his hand on her forehead. "You're warm."
"I'm fine. You just came from outside."
"So did you."
"I was in that oven you built me. I'm probably cooked."
He reaches for the cutting board. "Let me finish. I can make an omelet."
"Since when?"
"I'll have Lydia do it. She's good at that woman's work." Deborah stops cutting onions and slashes in his direction with the knife. "Unkindest cut of all," he says. It's like a little gift, the way he surprises her sometimes with the things he remembers.
"I used to teach that play," she says.
Without thinking, she quotes her own favorite line.
"Cowards die many times before their deaths.
The valiant never taste of death but once.
Pat sits at the counter.
That hurts more than the knife.
Lydia comes up the stairs then, towel drying her hair after her shower. She tells Deborah all over again that Ted and Isola were at the play and that they asked after her. Deborah knows by heart the inflection of their concern.
How is she?
Still alive.
Oh, the things she would say if she could.
But it's a minefield of courtesies and manners, this dying business. She's constantly being offered homeopathic remedies by the funky people up here. Magnets and herbs and horse liniments. Some people give her books, self-help books, tomes on grieving, pamphlets on dying.
I'm beyond help, self or otherwise, she wants to say. And aren't the grieving books more for the survivors?
And thanks for the book on dying, but that's the one part I have covered.
They'll ask Pat, how is she?
And they'll ask her, how are you? But they don't want to hear that she's tired all the time, that her bladder is leaky, that she's on the watch for her systems shutting down. They want to hear that she's at peace, that she's led a great life, that she's happy her son has returned. And so that's what she gives them. And the truth is, most of the time, she is at peace, has led a great life, is happy her son has returned. She knows which drawer the phone number for hospice is in, and the company with the hospital bed, and the provider of the morphine drip dispenser. Some days she wakes slowly from her nap and thinks it would be okay to just go on sleeping, that it would not be scary at all. Pat and Lydia are as solid as she could hope, and the board has agreed to let Lydia take over the theater. The cabin is paid for, with enough left in the bank for taxes and other expenses, so Pat can spend the rest of his life puttering around outside in the early mornings, which he loves, gardening, painting and staining, pruning trees, working on the driveway and the retaining walls, anything to keep his hands moving. Sometimes now, when she sees how content Pat and Lydia are, she feels like a spent salmon. Her work here is done. But other times, honestly, the whole idea of being at peace just pisses her off. At peace? Who but the insane would ever be at peace? What person who has enjoyed life could possibly think one is enough? Who could live even a day and not feel the sweet ache of regret? Sometimes during her various rounds of chemo, she had wanted the pain and discomfort to be over so badly that she could imagine being comforted by her own death. That was one of the reasons she'd decided, after all of the chemicals and radiations and surgeries, after the double mastectomy, after the doctors tried every measure of conventional and nuclear weaponry against her diminishing frame, and after they still found traces of cancer in her pelvic bones, to just let the thing run its course. Let it have her. The doctors said there might still be something to be done, depending on whether it was a primary or secondary cancer, but she told them it didn't matter anymore. Pat had come home, and she preferred 6 months of peace to another 3 years of needles and nausea. And she's gotten lucky. She's made it almost 2 years, and has felt good throughout most of it, although it still stuns her to catch a glimpse in the mirror. Who is this relic? This tall, thin, flat-chested old woman with her white porcupine hair. Deborah pulls her sweater around herself, warms her tea. She leans against the sink and smiles as she watches her son eat his second helping of eggs, Lydia reaching over to take a cheesy mushroom from the top. Pat looks up at his mother to see if she's caught the blatant thievery.
You're not going to stab her?
And that's when a car announces itself on the gravel outside. Pat hears it too and checks his watch. He shrugs.
No idea.
Pat goes to the window, puts his hand to the glass and peers down toward the driveway, the faint glow of headlights down there.
That's Keith's Bronco.
He steps away from the window. The after party, He's probably wasted.
I'll go take care of it.
He skips down the stairs like a boy.
How was he tonight?
Deborah asks quietly when he's gone. Lydia picks at the leftover onions and mushrooms on Pat's plate.
Great. You couldn't take your eyes off him. God, I'll be glad when this play is over, though. Some nights he just sits there afterward and stares out with these distant eyes. For 15 minutes he's just done. I feel like I've been holding my breath since I finished this goddamn play.
You've been holding your breath a lot longer than that, Deborah says, and they both smile.
It's a wonderful play, Lydia. You should just let go and enjoy it.
Lydia drinks from Pat's orange juice.
I don't know.
Deborah reaches across the table for Lydia's hand.
You had to write it, and he had to play it, and I'm just so grateful I got to see it.
Lydia cocks her head and her brow wrinkles, fighting off tears.
God damn it, Dee. Why do you do that?
Then, through 3 layers of floor, they hear voices on the stairs. Pat and Keith, and someone else, and then a rumbling up the steps. 5, maybe 6 sets of feet. Pat comes up first, shrugging.
I guess there were some old friends of yours at the show tonight, Mom. Keith brought them. I hope it's all right.
Pat is followed by Keith. He doesn't seem drunk, but he is carrying his little video camera, which he sometimes uses to chronicle... Hell, Deborah isn't sure what Keith chronicles exactly.
Hey, Dee, sorry to bother you so late, but these people really wanted to see you.
It's okay, Keith, she says, and then the other people come up the stairs, one at a time. An attractive young woman with curly red hair, and then a thin, mop-headed young man who does look drunk, neither of whom Deborah recognizes, and then a strange creature, a slightly hunched older man in a suit coat, as skinny as she is, at once vaguely familiar and not. He has the strangest, lineless face, like one of those computer renderings of a face aging, only done in reverse, a boy's face grafted onto the neck of an old man. And finally, another old gentleman, in a charcoal gray suit. This last man catches her attention as he steps away from the others, to the counter separating the kitchen from the living room. He removes his fedora and looks at her with a set of eyes so pale blue they seem nearly transparent, eyes that take her in a mixture of warmth and pity, eyes that sweep Dee Moray back 50 years to another life. He says,
"Hello, Dee."
Deborah's teacup drops to the counter.
"Pasquale?"
There were times, of course, years ago, when she thought she might see him again. That last day in Italy, as she watched him motor away from the hotel, she couldn't have imagined not seeing him again. Not that there was any spoken agreement between them, but there was something implicit, the hum of attraction and anticipation. When Alvis told her that Pasquale's mother had died, that he was going to the funeral and might not come back, Dee was stunned. Why hadn't Pasquale told her? And when a boat arrived with her luggage, and Alvis said Pasquale wanted him to get her back to the States safely, she thought that Pasquale must have needed some time alone. So she went home to have the baby. She'd sent him a postcard, thinking, maybe? But there was no answer. After that, she thought about Pasquale sometimes, although not as often as the years passed. She and Alvis did talk about going to Italy on vacation, going back to Porto Vergogna, but they never made it. Then, after Alvis died, and she got her degree in teaching, with a minor in Italian, she'd thought about taking Pat. She even called a travel agent who said that not only was there no listing for a hotel adequate view, but that she couldn't even find this town, Porto Vergogna. Did she perhaps mean Porto Venere? By then, Deborah could almost wonder if the whole thing, Pasquale, the fisherman, the paintings in the bunker, the little village on the cliffs, hadn't been some trick of the mind, another of her fantasies, a scene from some movie she'd watched. But no, here he is, Pasquale Tursi. Older, of course, his black hair gone slate gray, those deep lines in his face, his jaw falling into a slight jowl. But with the eyes, still the eyes, it is him. And he edges forward a step, until the only thing separating them is the kitchen counter. She feels a flash of self-consciousness, and her 22-year-old's vanity rises. God, what a fright she must look. For several seconds they stand there, a gimpy old man and a sick old woman, just 4 feet apart now, but separated by a thick granite counter, by 50 years and 2 fully lived lives. No one speaks. No one breathes. Finally, it is Dee Morey who breaks the silence, smiling at her old friend.
Perché hai perso così tanto tempo? What took you so long?
The smile is still too large for her lovely face, but what really gets to him is this. She has learned Italian. Pasquale smiles back and says quietly,
Mi dispiace. Avevo fare qualcosa d'importante.
I'm sorry. There was something important I had to do. Of the 6 other people fanned out around them in this room, only one understands what they've said. Shane Wheeler, who, even after 4 quick, desperate glasses of whiskey, is still moved by the bond translators often develop with their subjects. It's been quite a day for him. Waking up with Claire, finding out his movie pitch was nothing but a distraction, trying unsuccessfully to negotiate better terms during the long trip, then the catharsis of that play, identifying with the ruined life of Pat Bender, reaching out to and getting shut down by his ex. After all of that, and the whiskies, the emotion of Pasquale's reunion with Dee is almost more than Shane can bear. He sighs deeply, a little whoosh of air that brings the others back into the room. They all watch Pasquale and Dee intently. Michael Dean grips Claire's arm. She covers her mouth with her other hand. Lydia glances over at Pat. Even now she can't help worrying. Pat looks from his mother to this kindly old man. Did she call him Pasquale? And then his vision swings over to Keith, standing at the top of the stairs, moving to the side with that goddamn camera he carries everywhere, framing the scene, inexplicably filming this moment. What are you doing? He asks. Put that camera away. Keith shrugs and nods his head toward Michael Dean, the man paying him to do this. Deborah becomes aware, too, of the other people in the room. She looks around at the expectant faces until her eyes fall on the other old man, the one with the strange, plastic, impish face.
Jesus. She knows him, too. Michael Dean.
He draws his lips back over his brash, white teeth.
Hello, Dee.
Even now she feels dread just saying his name and hearing him say hers. Dean senses this because he looks away. She's read stories about him over the years, of course. She knows about his long trail of success. For a time she even stopped watching credits for fear of simply seeing his name. A Michael Dean production. Mom? Pat takes another step toward her. Are you okay?
I'm fine, she says.
But she stares at Michael, every eye following hers. Michael Dean feels their stares and he knows. This is his room now. And the room is everything. When you are in the room, nothing exists outside. The people hearing your pitch could no more leave the room than... Michael begins, turning to Lydia first and smiling all charm. And you must be the author of the masterpiece we just saw. He holds out his hand. Truly, it was a wonderful play. So moving.
Thank you,
Lydia says, shaking his hand. Now Dean turns back to Deborah. Always speak first to the toughest person in the room.
Dee, as I told your son downstairs, his performance was remarkable.